You know, Murph, they call the starts to these shows the cold openings to the podcast here before the musical credits. And I saw a minus 7 degrees on the thermometer in my car when I was driving to the airport to go to Detroit a couple of days ago. So that this will be a true cold opening to the Great American Hockey Show after that. That is, I've never seen the likes of that before.
Sounds good, but I'll tell you what's not cold, Joe, is trade rumors that are heating up right now. We're going to get into that in this show.
They are heating up. We'll get into that. We're also going to talk to NBC Sports Behind the Glass, Pierre McGuire will also be with us. So tune in for all that on this edition of the Great American Hockey Show. Start the music. And welcome back to the Great American Hockey Show. I'm your host, Joe Haggerty. I'm here with Bruins Daily writer James Murphy. Murph, how have you been the last couple of weeks? We're getting to an interesting time in the year.
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to seeing what unravels in the next couple of weeks as we approach the NHL trade deadline.
As I am, and should be interesting coming up here. The big question we have with the Bruins, as everything starts to pack down again, I mean, just a couple days ago, that Sunday afternoon game in Detroit, the Bruins had a chance to get within 2 points of the Florida Panthers. Everybody, aside from the Washington Capitals, is really starting to bunch together in the Eastern Conference. But, you know, there are still some signs with the Bruins that make you wonder how real they are. They give up 6 goals in that game. They really still have a hard time getting a good result in playoff intensity level games against good teams, which doesn't bode well for what their player performances are going to be. So I ask you, buyer, seller, what exactly are you if you're Don Sweeney in the next couple of weeks going into the trade deadline?
Well, as I've been preaching all along, I think they need to lean more towards being a seller at this point, but I think it's going to be a mix of both. For the Bruins, I think obviously, as they've stated to us, they want to get good now and in the future, and I think that's still their main goal there. I definitely do not see them by any means. I mean, it would shock me beyond disbelief if they were to pick up a rental. They're definitely looking for people with term or picks or prospects. But you know, you brought up something interesting there, Joe, and I think it's a great point. And I think that's the difference between the Bruins and a lot of these teams in the mix right now for a playoff spot, is the playoff intensity and the capability of this team elevating itself to that needed or necessary intensity for a playoff game. I don't think the Bruins have that in them right now. I don't think as a team, as a whole, they have the capability to play with that intensity that's needed to win in the playoffs. And when I look, you know, everyone says, well, look at the rest of the conference, it's all the same. No, it's not, though, really. Mm-hmm. If you dig deep and you really look at each team, you know, you've got teams like the Rangers who have been to the conference finals, twice in the last 4 years, been to the finals once. You've got the Washington Capitals, who we all know are battle-tested. You have the Detroit Red Wings, who haven't missed the playoffs in, 25 years now. And you have the New York Islanders, who I think have been building towards that intensity, have gotten some playoff experience under their belt. And also the Tampa Bay Lightning, who are there, and the Pittsburgh Penguins right on the precipice. So I think it's like, you look at the Bruins, and are they really with that group, or are they just sort of hanging around? And I think they're just sort of hanging around, and I think whether they make the playoffs or not, they're not going far.
I would think much more highly of the Bruins if I had seen more in some of the high-profile games that they've played.
Exactly.
You know, the Winter Classic, I think, was very revealing to me that they didn't show up for a game
when
like that.
When there's sort of a playoff atmosphere.
Yeah, the game where Milan Lucic and the Kings come back to TD Garden,
Anaheim Ducks game.
A no-show. The Anaheim Ducks, the game right before the NHL All-Star break. You know, even that game against Detroit, they've got a chance to move within a couple of points of Florida. And granted, they don't have Patrice Bergeron, and that certainly was a factor. But, you know, you can't give up 6 goals in a game and expect and have Zdeno Chara on ice for all 6 goals allowed and let their best players, Datsyuk, Zetterberg, Justin Ablokator, just run wild all over you and expect to compete. And they haven't been enough. They've beaten bad teams. They've beaten teams that they should beat. They're above average in the NHL among the 30 teams. I think they've shown that and that they should make the playoffs based on what they've done. they're nowhere close to above average when you look at the playoff field and the playoff teams that are there. And I think their youth and some of the holes in their roster are really exposed and come out when they play those good teams and when the intensity really gets bumped up a couple of levels. And, you know, for that reason, I wouldn't be willing to give up serious assets to get a rental.
Not at all.
You know, and the thing is, too, I don't know what's going to be out there for rentals. They need a defenseman. Dustin Byfuglien is re-signed. Dennis Weidman's not going to get moved now after that suspension, or not likely to anyway. Keith Yandel, everything I've been told from people around the Rangers is he's not going to get moved, and that's even more so now with Ryan McDonough hurt. Kevin Shattenkirk in St. Louis now with Alex Petrangelo hurt, and so many injuries on their back end. He's not going to get moved as well. You know, there's Justin Schultz in Edmonton that you could go after as an RFA. Yeah, Ham Hughes is another one for sure. But, like, are Don Sweeney and Cam Neely going to talk trade with Peter Chiarelli to try to get Justin Schultz from Edmonton when they really wouldn't do that during the summertime? I think all of that stuff is interesting, and it creates a scenario now where the Bruins were optimistic maybe a month ago that they were going to be able to get a significant game-changing young defenseman and that it might happen for them. But I think the way the cards have played out here, the young D-men that they really want aren't going to get moved until the summertime, and there's not a big pool right now of veteran defensemen to choose from.
Well, I mean, you bring up the young D-men there, and the only team that I think is still a question mark on whether they might move somebody is Minnesota. With the change that's happened there now, if they don't respond to the coaching change there and they continue to decline under Torchetti as they were under Mike Yeo, I think that maybe, just maybe, Minnesota maybe pedals off one of those guys. But then again, I'm leaning more with you where it's they're likely, if you're management, you maybe just want to take the last quarter of the season here or you know and kind of reevaluate your roster, whether you're winning or losing, and then take what you learned and apply it at the draft and make a deal there. So I'm with you. Like I think.
I think the Matthew Dumba, Jacob Trouba, Sammy Vatanen, Cam Fowler, like any of those guys, I think will end up if they get dealt, get traded in the summertime around the draft rather than in the next 2 weeks in a rush job of a trade.
Well, I think if I'm Don Sweeney right now, my primary focus right now is to move Louis Erickson and get the best possible return for him. What that best possible return is, I don't know. It better be. Hopefully, at least a first rounder. But if you listen to Pierre LeBrun recently say that, you know, general managers aren't looking at rentals as equaling first rounders like they did last year when we saw Antoine Vermette go.
We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see what happens there. It's still a few weeks before the deadline, and teams aren't really desperate. And there hasn't been a trade yet that set the rental market to prove that to be true. So I think a lot of that could be posturing.
Get what you can for him. And then whether it happens now or it happens at the draft, start to really contemplate what you can get for Zdeno Chara. I know they've been looking at it all season. They're never going to tell us that. You were dead on when you reported it in the beginning of the season when they went 0-3 to start the season. Mm-hmm. I've got a zillion sources across the NHL telling me that basically the Bruins flat out lied. I mean, the Bruins are entertaining the thought of moving their captain, and they have been for a while, and they'd be crazy not to right now. The problem with this defense right now is that he is looked upon as a number one defenseman, and they don't have anybody that can come in and make him fall into the slot where he should be right now. I'm not saying that Zdeno Chara is as horrible as he's looked lately. I still think he could be a great number three or number four for a contending team that has two younger guys in their prime in front of him as the one and two. That's what you got to look at right now. And the first two places I would go to, they're both looking up.
L.A.
L.A. Mm-hmm. and Chicago.
Yep.
He's got Slovakian connections there. Okay, you got Marian Gaborik in L.A. You have Marian Hossa in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That will play a role in him waving his no trade. I would be on the horn with Stan Bowman and Dean Lombardi right now if I was Don Sweeney. And if it can't materialize for the trade deadline, at least you set the groundwork for after the season.
Yeah, and I do think that they're going to entertain it at some point, and they have to seriously consider doing it. The thing is, I still get the sense, right or wrong, and it might be wrong, that they want to get into the playoffs this year, that they want to return back there, and if they trade him, they're just not getting into the playoffs. I think they can withstand trading Louis Erickson,
okay,
and still maybe get that playoff push.
Get those feelers out there.
Because look, if you trade Louis Erickson, Murph, you open up a spot for Frank Vetrano to come back up here,
which he should be.
Got 20 goals in 19 games in the AHL, yeah, and is completely dominating down there. And this season should be about developing the young players and getting in the playoffs. And part of developing young players is now, when they deserve it,
throw them in the,
bringing them back up to the NHL and letting them develop here.
Because especially at this time of year,
I'm not sure how much good it's doing him to score a goal per game in the AHL where he's just dominating down there.
And look at the lessons he could be learning at this time of year when the games intensify like that. That's a great time for a young player to be in there. And I'm sorry if maybe you don't make the playoffs because maybe you played a little too much youth there and you took this chance to let these guys learn and get baptized by fire, so be it. I'd rather see that. And, you know, I get the position they're in. I get the money they're going to get at the gate. I understand the financial position they're in when it comes to making the playoffs. I understand that. But you have to look at the bigger picture. And one of the reasons that they said they let go of Peter Chiarelli is that the organization as a whole had lost its grasp on the bigger picture and was just focusing too much on the now. Well, then practice what you preach. And to this point, this management team has not done that yet. And you know, I don't care if they don't make any deals.
I think they
the
have.
The team is good enough right now to make the playoffs. Then let them make the playoffs.
I think they have done it, Murph. I think just they've been 1 foot in and 1 foot out to this point. You know, they have done it. I mean, trading Dougie Hamilton and trading Milan Lucic for all kinds of future assets and restocking your prospect supply and getting first round picks. I think all of those things are
the
bigger
one
picture
foot in, one foot
and
out.
Looking towards the future. The issue is, you know, are they going to cannonball in completely at some point? And trading Chara, you know, trading Seidenberg, doing things like that would absolutely be doing that. And I just don't think that they're there yet this season. Maybe after the year is out. Maybe if they bottomed out like if they played like they did the first three games of the season, I think they would be, for more of the year, I think they'd be much more inclined to do that. I think the fact that you're looking at them right now in third place in the Atlantic Division, well within the pack of playoff teams, that by and large they should be able to hang on and get in over the final couple months of the season,
right,
is going to keep them from going full in completely to just blow everything up and start over again. But, you know, and also I don't think the fan base around here would have the patience for it. I think it's a hard sell to Boston fans now to just completely bottom out when they've been so spoiled with championships over the last 10, 15 years. I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying this is reality for the Bruins and the organization, and I think this enters into their thinking, and it's why I say I think they're going to sell more than they're going to buy. I think the more significant player, whether it's coming in or going out, is going to be Louis Erickson. You know, him going out, I think, is going to be more significant than any players that they bring in. I think they may get a rental at defenseman. Maybe they get like a Ham Hughes or a Jonathan Michael Lyles or somebody like that that's only going to cost them, you know, a nominal draft pick and not going to cost them a lot in terms of a future asset. And just to get a veteran in here that, you know, might be a little more steady than, you know, Kevin Miller or Joe Morrow or Zach Trotman or even Colin Miller, who struggled a little bit. I'd like to see him in the lineup because I think it's about developing the young players this year as well. And he should be in there to take the lumps and to learn the lessons. But I think they're going to be much more sellers than buyers at this point. I don't see Don Sweeney mortgaging anything to bring in any kind of player unless they're going to help them in the long term. And if you're the Bruins, do you want to bring in a Jack Johnson and take on everything that he represents and the money that he's owed because you have a need at defenseman? I think that's when it really starts to get dangerous for this team and, you know, making a decision like that.
You know, Joe, but you talk about blowing it up, and is trading Zdeno Chara necessarily blowing things up?
I think it is because you're no longer even a viable playoff team.
Why?
With their defenseman core, Murph, you're not a viable playoff team without him.
Why?
Because he's the guy that's the only guy that can play close
he's
to 24, 25 minutes a night.
He's the guy that's on the ice for six goals against Detroit.
Yeah, he has bad games, but he also
has a lot more bad than good.
No, Murph.
You know,
what I'm trying to say is, we're
looking around at the Eastern Conference right now.
Hold on. If you trade Zdeno Chara, you know who your number one defenseman is?
But we're not factoring
You know who your number one defenseman is?
Why isn't it what you get
Torrey
back?
Torrey Krug.
Why isn't it what you get back?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get a defenseman back that's going to be able to help them. I think they'd get picks. They'd get other things. I don't see them getting a young defenseman that's going to be able to step in. Especially the Blackhawks and the Kings don't have those kind of players. The Blackhawks and the Kings are looking for defensemen. They're not looking to trade away defensemen.
They've got some great young players that could step in and play.
The bottom line is, Murph, if you trade Zdeno Chara your number one defenseman is Torrey Krug. And if your number one defenseman is Torrey Krug and he has to start playing 25 minutes a night and going up against the other team's best players, guess what? You're blowing it up. That's a rebuild.
But you could still make the playoffs. That's how mediocre the Eastern Conference is.
Yeah, right. I don't think you could. I think that would be a complete defensive collapse if you did that. I mean,
I disagree. I think the defense has collapsed already around him.
I think there's sound thinking.
I think he is
sound
the reason for the collapse.
No. I think if he were put in more realistic position, he wouldn't be a part of the collapse.
You know what? I'm going to go back, and I'll have to look it up.
I mean, if he were – Murph, if they had better defensemen and he was a 3-4 and playing 20 minutes a night, the Bruins would be much better off. He's being forced right now to play the old role that he had. He's not as good at it, but he still has plenty of good nights that are helping them win against bad teams. The problem is he's getting exposed against really good offensive teams with speed and with skill, and this is why they're going to lose in the playoffs. But Zdeno Chara being there makes them good enough to make the playoffs, just not win in the playoffs. So
see, I disagree. You know why? Because I think that when you take a guy like Chara out of lineup, that obviously they're focusing everything on him, and everybody revolves around him on that defense right now, especially with these young guys. They look to him to back them up, to gain experience off, to learn lessons from. When you take a guy like that out, though, sometimes the group as a whole tightens up to replace his absence there, to go in and just replace what you're missing from him. They tighten up and they play better as a unit. Goes back to the old Bill Simmons, Patrick Ewing theory, okay? When the Knicks refused to move away from Patrick Ewing.
So you think Dennis Seidenberg is going to find the fountain of youth and Kevin Miller is going to become a much better player with Zdeno
Chara? I don't think they're going to become better players. I think they're going to tighten up. I think they're going to stop depending on a guy that you can't depend on right now, and they're going to depend on themselves and pick up the slack a bit.
All right. I'm not buying.
All right.
Buyer and seller at the deadline, the Bruins. Final word.
Both. Yep.
Sell Louis Erickson and buy a defenseman. Who do you think it's going to be?
Get some gonads and trade the big Z.
Who do you think it's going to be?
What, the defenseman?
Yeah, coming back.
I still think Minnesota could unleash a
Matthew
nice,
Dumba,
yeah, or Brody, and Brody, if he's healthy enough. Yeah.
Okay. I have them more sellers than buyers. Louis Erickson definitely going to get moved because they're not going to be able to re-sign him. I think there will be some kind of defenseman coming back. I think it's going to be very underwhelming in the Andre Mazaros level of player to just kind of fill a space and be a veteran guy that's, you know, better than Zach Trotman, potentially Joe Morrow and Kevin Miller.
Are we talking like Greg Zannon here?
No, Dan Hamhuis is fine, I guess. I mean,
I think he's a good defenseman.
He'd be better
as long
as they don't have to give up a lot for him. But I'd say more seller than buyer. And we welcome in our guest, NHL scout, NHL assistant head coach on Stanley Cup winning teams, NHL head coach, assistant general manager formerly, and now everybody knows him inside the glass on all NHL broadcasts, whether you're watching NBCSN or NBC Sports Network and watching the Winter Classic on New Year's Day. Pierre McGuire. Pierre, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very nice to visit with you, gentlemen, from lovely St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, there you go. God's country in St. Louis. At the start of every interview, we go back to the very beginnings. So if you can indulge us, just tell us where you were born, where you grew up, and sort of where your love of hockey was born from in the first place.
Well, when I was a little boy growing up, obviously I grew up in Montreal. I was born in the United States, but moved to Canada when I was really young and moved to a city where they had a team by the name of the Montreal Canadiens, and they seemingly won all the time. But I had an uncle that was really good friends with some of the equipment people with the Canadiens. And so I remember probably 67 or 68, I was really young. The Detroit Red Wings came into town. It was the opening of the refurbished Forum in Montreal. They took the steel girders out, very few obstructed seats that they had before. And I went to that game. I think it was opening night. I'm pretty sure it was opening night. I got to meet Alex Delvecchio and Gordie Howe for Detroit. And then on the other side, I got to meet Pocket Rocket Richard and Yvon Cornway and Jean Beliveau. Those guys were larger than life. And so you're talking about a kid who's either 7 or 8 years old. having the good fortune to meet those players and spend time around the room and to see what it was like, and I was hooked. I was completely and utterly hooked from that time on.
That's great. Now, Pierre, how did you end up in Canada? Was it your father have to move there for work?
I couldn't hear what you guys just said. I apologize.
Okay. I was saying, how did you your family end up moving up to Montreal? Was it because of one of your parents having to move there for work?
Yeah, my father started a company up in Canada. My mother was Canadian. My dad was American from North Dakota in Michigan, where he grew up as a little boy, and he started a business up in Montreal. So that's why we moved.
Now, was it true? I saw on Wikipedia, and obviously who the hell knows what's true and what's not true on Wikipedia, but that you moved from Montreal maybe around your teenage years back to the U.S. because of the Francophone, Anglophone thing and your dad's business and all that. Was that accurate?
It's part of it is, part of it's not. It was pretty hard for my dad's business at the time to stay afloat only because there were so many different language requirements in Montreal, but it was more than just that. One of the reasons why I moved back to the States is because I was recruited by a high school in New Jersey by the name of Bergen Catholic High School that had a real good hockey program and they're still one of the top football teams in the East and probably at that time in the United States. So I had a real passion for football and a real passion for hockey and eventually moved back down there and, fortunate that I did. I was able to get a real good education and still play sports.
Yeah, how did that change, do you think, the formative experience for you in the world of hockey and just as an athlete in general rather than if you had stuck around Montreal going that path instead?
Well, I think if I would have stayed in Montreal, I wouldn't have played as much football. I would have played a lot more hockey, which would have been great for me just because I had the passion for it. But I love, all sports, and the thing is that I was very lucky. My parents trusted me and allowed me to move away and not be with them. It would have been a little bit different if they didn't have the trust in me. So I feel so blessed because my parents trusted me and gave me every opportunity to get an amazing education. And because of that trust, it also allowed me to build, what I did in sports. So I'm really grateful for that.
And Pierre, talk about, too, going back to what you gained sort of as that passion for hockey in Montreal and how you applied it playing down in the States and how it sort of translated into what you ended up doing as you went on in your career.
Well, I've always been a rink rat. I've always wanted to be around the rink. I'm in St. Louis now. I got to the rink at 8:45 this morning, visited with the Dallas coaches and visited with the Blues players and coaches and just finished watching them practice, and I'll work tonight in St. Louis and tomorrow in New York City. People say to me all the time, don't you get tired of it? And the day I get tired of it is the day I'll quit. It's one of those things where, and I tell my little boy this too all the time, he's a pretty good player. Tell him, if you don't have the passion, go to the rink every day and learn something new, then you shouldn't do it because you're not going to get any better at it. And every day should be an endless quest to try to make yourself better at it when you're in professional sport, but in sport in particular, or any walk of life, and that's how I've tried to live. But my passion for sports has been huge since I've been a little guy, and I'm really appreciative for every opportunity I've gotten. I think, obviously everybody needs a break, and one of the biggest breaks I ever got is when Scotty Bowman saw me working and coaching, and eventually he hired me, and that was the biggest break I ever got.
Any stories in particular that come to mind with Scotty Bowman and just your experiences with him that you always tell people when they ask about him?
I don't think we have time.
I'm sure there's a million, but like one that always sticks out in your mind that talks about him as a coach, as an individual, as a hockey person.
Well, I'll tell you more about Scotty than I want to tell you about our relationship because I have so much respect for the man. He's like an older brother and a father that I lost 7 years ago. My dad was my best friend, and he died working on our land up in Canada in a tree cutting accident. Scotty was right there from the start. He's always been there. He's an amazingly loyal friend. He's been amazing to me and my family. He hired me out of St. Lawrence University. I was really young. I was 28 or 29. And I'll never forget him turning me loose on the road and really teaching me a lot about how to build a team, how to coach a team, how to deal with players, how to deal with management. One of the first things he ever said to me before I went on a real long road trip as a scout, he said, spend every single nickel like it's your own. And if you do that, you'll never get in trouble with your ownership or with your general manager. And I was like, that's a real good lesson. So that's how I started. But Scotty's always been great. The thing that's really helped him in his career, I think, he coached in five decades, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and his last game was 2002 when they beat Carolina for the Stanley Cup in Detroit. And one of the things that allowed him to survive five decades is he kept changing with the times. You know, he became friends with Don Shula. He became friends with Joe Torre. He became friends with Sparky Anderson, guys that were great coaches and managers that transcended time. And he would pick their brains and try to get information from them. But the biggest thing that allowed Scotty to coach all those years and all those different decades is his ability to change with the times. And I tell people this all the time. Scotty Bowman could have been a lawyer. He could have been a doctor. He could have been a politician. He could have been an entrepreneur. He could have been anything he wanted to be. His IQ is off the charts, and his ability to understand difficult problems and make them very simple for people to understand is amazing.
You know, Pierre, I've talked to you many times about Scotty before, and I've had the pleasure of talking to him in person too, and he's one of those guys, I'm sure you agree with me, when you're in his presence, you know you're in the presence of greatness. And I guess as you go on in your career after what you learned with him, did you meet anyone else like that that had an influence on you as well?
Well, you know, again, Scotty's just, we lived together. We lived together and we won together. And I remember one time his wife, Suella, said, I don't know how you do it. Because I couldn't do it at that time. But I think the biggest thing with him is he still is, by the way, such a great family man. I remember we would have games on Saturday nights in Pittsburgh or Saturday afternoons even sometimes, and he would get in the car right away. His family was living in Buffalo, and he would drive home, whether it was at night or in the afternoon, and he would get home, have breakfast with his children, take them to Mass, and then he would drive back or he would go to Toronto and then meet the team on the road, wherever we were. He was amazing that way, and he never once complained about being tired or fatigued or anything else. I could tell so many great stories about him because I know them all to be true because I lived them, but I could also tell you that there are not a lot of guys that have had careers in the NHL that have been so great to so many people, even though they're perceived as being rough and gruff. I don't think the image of Scotty Bowman has been truly shared properly by a lot of people around the league.
And, you know, you talk about him being a family man, Pierre, and I know just, you know, from getting to know you over the years, you make it a point, too, to always go back and be there for your kids, whether it's for their hockey games or just to spend time with them. Is that sort of how that's translated from what you learned from Scotty?
Scotty used to tell me all the time, you better call home at least twice a day, once when you wake up and once before you go to bed, and tell everybody how much you care about them. My dad was very much like that to me when I was growing up. My dad didn't live around the house very often because he was always out working. But I know that he didn't miss many of my games or my brother's running events or my other brother's games or my sister's games. We were a family of four, and my dad really made a lot of sacrifices, as did my mother, by the way, but lots of sacrifices to make sure that there was always a parental presence, whether it was at a practice or a game. And yeah, I think a lot of that came from my parents, but also seeing Scotty and what he did. Sure, I've been fortunate too to work for people, especially at NBC, that really understand the importance of family.
No doubt.
Last year during the Quebec Pee Wee tournament, I did a game in Chicago, and that night my son's team was playing Syracuse Nationals, which was the number two team in the United States for Triple A hockey, and they won the game. I was getting text messages from Peter DeBoer and Chris Draper, two guys whose kids were playing in the tournament too. They were playing for different teams. And this was during the game in Chicago, and in the third period, you know, both guys said, hey, Ryan's team won. So I called Sam Flood, the executive producer of the NHL on NBC. I said, listen, my son's got a game up in Quebec in 2 days, but you have me scheduled to do an NHL game in Pittsburgh. Do you mind if I miss it to go see this? And Sam was like, absolutely, you got to go to that. So it just shows you that you may have the heart to do it, but you better have a boss that's capable of handling that too and telling you, yeah, you know what, it's okay to care about your family.
Yeah, and I could speak firsthand, obviously working for Comcast Sportsnet as a part of NBC Sports, that family first is definitely the mantra in the business model for everybody here, and it makes for better workers, it makes for a better work environment, it makes for happier people. Speaking of happy people, maybe sometimes not so happy, I wonder how you approach this. How does Pierre Maguire, who's coached in the NHL, who, you know, knows people around hockey, how does he react when he's watching his son play in these tournaments in person? Are you a pretty calm dad? Are you pretty boisterous? Like, how would you describe Pierre Maguire hockey dad?
You know what? Usually I sit back and watch. I get probably as excited as anybody else. I don't try to vocalize too much. I kind of let the referees do their thing. I don't always agree with them.
I was going to say, do you take it easy on the refs, Pierre?
I definitely do not give any flack to the refs, but I'm sitting there in my brain going, no, I don't know if you got that right. But no, I'm pretty mellow that way. I think I'm probably more demonstrative when I get a chance to go on the ice and work with young players. You know, it's a good story. 2 weeks ago, there was a huge snowstorm in Connecticut, and I wasn't working that day. So I called up a friend of mine who's got a few boys, and I said, hey, listen, if you want, I'll take the boys out on the ice. We just have to go rent some ice. And Mike Backman, who played for the New York Rangers back in the late 70s, early 80s, his son-in-law is Matt Molson. The other boy is Jonathan Quick. Those are his two son-in-laws. Anyways, he runs a rink in Connecticut. And Mike actually said, yeah, I'll go on the ice with you guys. So we went out and did a clinic for some of the local kids. And it was phenomenal. I had such a blast. And at the end of it, one of the boys said, Mr. Maguire, I didn't know you could raise your voice so loud. So it was pretty good.
Good stuff. Pierre, I want to go into your professional coaching career. And obviously the highlight had to be in Pittsburgh when you guys won the Cup there in 1992. Just take us back to that and just being part of something like that. I mean, Joe and I know from, you know, covering hockey and having the pleasure to cover the Bruins Cup run in 2011, how it becomes such a family. And, you know, when guys win it, they always have that for the rest of their life, no matter what, no matter where they end up, whether it's in TV, whether it's another hockey club. Just talk about, you know, going on that run with that team and the bond you formed and the bond you still keep.
Well, I mean, coaching in the NHL is a privilege that you got to earn every day. It's kind of like playing in the NHL. I was really young working in Pittsburgh and had a lot of real new ideas. Our staff was amazingly tight. Rick Keel, Barry Smith, Rick Patterson, Scotty Bowman, Joe Malosh, myself. We were really, really tight as a group. Had a chance to really do a lot because Scotty delegated so well. So did the late Bob Johnson. You never forget the first time, and you know I'll never forget Game 6 in Minnesota in 1991. Won the game 8-0. We had a substantial lead early on in the game. Alfie Samuelson scored the first goal, and then the rest was history. But what my takeaway from that is seeing the Cup brought onto the ice and seeing all the fans in Bloomington, Minnesota, staying till the end, even though it was a blowout, and giving both teams a rousing ovation. It was really amazing to be part of that. So I have a lot of good stories on that and takeaway. And then obviously in 92, we won 11 games in a row to win the Stanley Cup. People forget that. It's an NHL record. And the two rinks where Pittsburgh won the Cup in the 90s, the Met Center in Bloomington and the Chicago Stadium are now both parking lots. One is for the Mall of America and the other one's for the United Center in Chicago. So I'm dating myself a little bit, but I think the biggest thing you learn when you coach in the league is you have to always continue to have standards and to focus on your players. And whether they're having good days, bad days, you know, medium days, you've always got to focus in on your players and make sure that their needs are being taken care of all the time.
Remembering that the sweet taste of that experience with the Cup and, you know, some of the satisfaction that you got from coaching and being a part of that sort of day-to-day competition, obviously you get plenty out of being behind the glass and inside the glass for NBC and analyzing the games. But how big is that tug at times, even though you're in a phenomenal job and you're in the hockey world every single day, to get back into that competitive environment of the coaching, of being a GM, of being a part of an organization? I know you had pretty substantial talks with the Penguins a couple of years ago. How big a tug is there for you to potentially drop back into that world at some point before, you know, you call it a day?
That's an awesome question. There's not a day that goes by where I don't miss it. I don't miss the interaction. You know, I just really miss the interaction with the players. I miss the pressure that's being brought to bear on winning and losing. I miss the opportunity to help build a team. I miss the opportunity to help make young players better. There's so many things that I miss about it. But one of the things I'm so grateful for is to be around it still. And for NBC and for Sam Flood in particular, who have invented this idea of broadcasting from between the benches, inside the glass, and trying to bring people to a place most of them have never been before, ice level of an NHL game. But I miss it every day. I tell my wife that all the time, you know. My perfect retirement job would be to go to a, whether it be a Division I college or a Division III college in New England, and be an assistant coach, teach a class, and work with young players. That would be like the ultimate retirement job for me. I have to tell you, some of my fondest memories go back to when I coached the Babson College with Steve Sterling, and running the hockey camps at Babson and running the Europa Cup for Dick Flood and for Steve Sterling, and the amount of hours we spent on the ice and how much you learned. I mean, I remember having players like Jeremy Roenick and Keith Tkachuk and Sean McEachran, Tony Amonte, Billy Guerin, Scotty LaChance, Bert Snow. It's an endless array of great players that I had the privilege of working with when they were young kids and people didn't even know who they were. So, no, it's one of those things that I love being at the rink, and I'll always miss it. But for anybody that's listening that's a college athletic director and you're looking for a guy in 10 years, I'm your guy.
Well, hey, look, there's a Doc Emmerich. I could see there being a Professor McGuire, no question about it. Come on, teach a class and coach hockey.
Sounds like a plan. Pierre, obviously, you know, we're here. We've had the pleasure of working with Claude Julien, covering him over the since he's been here since 2007, 2008. But, you know, it's interesting. I want to switch a little more to current talk here. He gets so much flack here in the Boston area. And to me, I don't think that people here understand the respect he has around the league, amongst other coaches, amongst GMs, amongst players. Why do you think here that he's sort of had a tough time getting, in my eyes, getting the respect he deserves?
I don't know, but I can tell you one thing, Jimmy. He's a tremendous, tremendous coach. I look at what he's done just with Ryan Spooner this year. I look at the development of Torrey Krug over time. I think they've done a fantastic job cultivating what it means to be a Bruin, how to be a Bruin. There's a reason why they're a playoff team right now, especially with all the lineup changes that have gone on. I think Claude and Dougie Huda and Joe Sacco and Doug Jarvis, Bobby Essence, I think those guys have done a magnificent job coaching that team. Claude is a very respected guy around the hockey community in the NHL. That's one of the reasons why he was an assistant coach to Babcock at the Olympics in Sochi. And Claude was really counted on by Mike to do a lot of stuff. But one of the things I really like about Claude, no nonsense. He doesn't play favorites. He holds guys accountable. There's a high level of standard. But I'll give you an example. 2 years ago, there was a game in Chicago, and Ryan Spooner made a bad decision and ended up being put in the Bruins' net. The next power play out, Claude Julien put him right on the ice again, and he eventually got an assist on a play, and Spooner elevated his game. And I know how hard they've worked with him, but I think, to make a long story short, I think Claude Julien is one of the most underappreciated coaches in the league. And if the Bruins make the playoffs, and I believe they will, and the Bruins do what I think they're capable of, this will be one of the better coaching jobs Claude has ever done.
No, I agree. And, you know, there was a lot at the midpoint of the season talk about who deserves Jack Adams' consideration. I didn't see his name mentioned in a lot of corners, and I think he absolutely does deserve it with the team that he has right now and the coaching job that he has. And it's interesting. I've talked to him in the past about his influences, and, you know, he's mentioned Scotty Bowman and the conversations that he's had with him, and it, almost exactly like what you talked about, Pierre, with the adjustments and changing things over the years and sort of having to adjust your game and your coaching style as the league adjusts and changes. Have you seen, even just over the course of his time coaching the Bruins, Claude Julien really adjust with the times and make changes? Because a lot of people here, I think one of the criticisms he gets is that he hasn't changed enough as coach, but I feel like you've seen him make adjustments all the time, mm-hmm. even including this year.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Use the power play as an example. Going from a traditional overload or an umbrella power play to playing the 1-3-1 with Bergeron being the bumper, that's a phenomenal tactical development for the Bruins, and it's really paid off. Their power play is been all world this year, and it's helped them. I think last year they were 16th in the league on the power play and 17th in the league on the penalty kill. And look at, they're in the top five more nights than not in both categories. That's significant improvement. That's coaching, especially when you look at the way the roster's changed. That's one example. Another example, more aggressive offensively on the forecheck. He was a disciple of the late Pat Burns, and Pat was more of a defensive coach than an offensive coach. But he's been able to, a lot like Al Lamino, by the way, with the Rangers, change with the times, especially with the red line coming out, and be more of an aggressive offensive team with stretch passes, more an aggressive 2-1-2 forecheck. Lots of different things Claude has done. So, no, I think he's done a great job in terms of evolving. But the last part I'll leave you with is he's one of the better guys in the league when it comes to running a bench. He does a real good job running his bench.
Great minds think alike. Pierre, I was just going to bring that up. I remember a game, I can't recall which one it was last year, where you were between the glass, between the benches on a Bruins game on NBC. And they came out, and I think they quickly went down 2-0, maybe even 3-0. And he calls a timeout, and he adjusts, and you can see their system change as the game goes on. And then later in the game, you know, they went to you on the bench there, and you pointed it out. You said, look, I was listening. I heard what he said in the timeout, and now it's translating onto the ice. And that's a thing where I don't think people realize that he does adjust a lot, not just game to game, not season to season, but I've seen him adjust within a game. And that's what really strikes me as a good coach.
Oh, that's well said. I agree with that, Jimmy. I mean, the biggest thing to me with him is he has a sense for when his players are going, when they're not going. I believe the game you're alluding to actually took place in Pittsburgh, if I remember correctly. You do so many. But I believe that game was in Pittsburgh when he did that, and I was really, really impressed. I mean, he basically got the Bruins to win that night. No, Claude's great. I hope that people understand. I know Donnie Sweeney understands. And I think, by the way, giving out plaudits, I think Donnie's done a tremendous job trying to reinvigorate this roster and change a little bit of the dynamic of how the Bruins play. Really, really good job. I hate to do this to you guys, but I got another job to do. I got to get in there to a meeting with Ken Hitchcock right now.
No
so
worries.
I'm going to have to let you go.
No worries.
Pierre, thank you very much for the time. We appreciate it, my friend.
Oh, good visiting with you, gentlemen. Take care. We'll see you soon.
All right. Take care. Well, we thank Pierre McGuire very much for his time, even though he had to get into a meeting with Ken Hitchcock and start doing his day job. Let's do a little bit of our day jobs, Murph, and decide who we think is pretender and who is contender around the NHL. You know, in the East, it is tough to gauge beyond Washington. They're the clear contender, probably the cream of the crop in the entire league, not just the Eastern Conference. But you go down beyond them, and I think Florida has proven enough, especially the goal differential impresses me. But, you know, this is a young man's league. They've got a lot of really good young players. They've got some interesting veterans that are sprinkled in there.
A real interesting one in 44-year-old Jaromir Jagr.
Absolutely. Roberto Luongo is fairly interesting himself, too. Don't sell him short. But, you know, the Eastern Conference can be very difficult to read because there are some teams like Tampa Bay and Pittsburgh that are very talented but have been kind of underachieving for most of the year. As far as the East goes, who is your biggest pretender and who's your biggest contender?
Well, like I said earlier in the show, Joe, I think you have to really look at the teams that are battle-tested in previous playoff runs, you know, in the last few years. And I think right now if we're going to look at the teams hovering around the last wild card spot there, you got New Jersey, Tampa Bay, Pittsburgh, Carolina – still hanging on there. I look at Tampa Bay and Pittsburgh as the two teams maybe to even out there and take the last two wild card spots, or maybe, you know, you alternate Boston in there as well. But I think Tampa Bay is a very battle tested team. Obviously, they went to the Stanley Cup Finals last year. They were in the playoffs the year before. I like their team. They've made it clear now they're going to keep Steven Stamkos. That lifts a huge weight off that team. It puts a distraction.
Well, keep them through the deadline.
For the deadline, yeah. Yes. They're not going to trade him, so they know that they're not going to have another Marty St. Louis, Neil Callahan-type trade again in the middle of the season. They're not going to have that. And I think that's huge.
Yeah, but it still doesn't preclude it from being a distraction, his whole contract not being signed, and what's he going to do?
I think it kind of quells it a bit, though. I think it doesn't put it completely to the side, but it shifts the focus more to, like, let's go on a run here. And we'll worry about that later. I mean, obviously, it's in the back of their heads, but I don't think the players are going to be asked about it as much in the next 2 weeks because they know he's not going anywhere until at least July 1st. So, and then I look at teams like the Rangers and the Islanders.
Wait until the playoffs, though, Murph, when the Toronto reporters start covering all the playoff series and they hit Tampa Bay and start asking them every day what's going on.
Yeah, but I think the New York Rangers, too, are a team we have to look at really closely. This is a team that I think is completely underachieved. Their window's closing, but they're starting to gain steam. You see them kind of unifying and coming together as a team. I don't know if you saw what they did against the Flyers the other day. You know, when McGrath goes out there and gets redemption on Simmons there, drops the gloves with him for Simmons' sucker punch to their captain, Ryan McDonough. They're starting to play like a team there. And Lundqvist is the type of guy that can get hot at the right time. That's a team I keep an eye out. So there's a lot of teams there that, yeah, they've sort of been average throughout the season, but this is their time of year now. And I think three of those teams right now would be the Rangers, the Lightning, and the Islanders, I think, are a team that is just about ready to blossom.
Yeah, and the most interesting thing, I guess, with the Islanders right now is the goaltending situation. And I've never been a big Yaroslav Halak fan. And I had people telling me earlier in the year that have some pretty deep connections in the Isles dressing room that watch out for Greiss. They really like him. They think he's better than Halak. I think the sentiment inside the dressing room is that Greiss gives them a better chance to win and that, you know, that's making it difficult for Halak there. And that he may end up just completely taking over by the time they get down the stretch run into the playoffs. And it's sort of happening that way. I wonder how that's going to play out once they get to the playoffs, if this becomes a real full-bloom goalie controversy between the two of them. Because Halak has been good enough at times to really show you something, but not good enough to ever hold on to a job anywhere. And I think the same thing is playing out here with the Islanders. But there's no doubt, you know, you look at Tavares, you look at Okpozo, Letty Boychuk, you know, there's a top pairing. They've got some serious talent, and I think there'll be a handful in the playoffs. There are a number of teams, whether it's Washington, whether it's the Islanders, whether it's the Rangers, Florida. I think Detroit is definitely for real. I like Mrazek as a goaltender. I still think, you know, they've got an interesting balance of young and old. The defenseman core still isn't what it needs to be. It isn't good enough, but I think they're certainly better than the Bruins. You know, the one team I know they've played better under Mike Sullivan, but the Pittsburgh Penguins, I think that team's still a mystery to me, and yeah. I still think something is wrong there and that they're going to, you know, seriously examine trading Sidney Crosby after the year is out and really start exploring that because something's not working there. I love Tommy Fitz. I'm glad he was on the show a couple weeks ago, but I really feel like maybe the Devils are kind of a pretender and they've been sort of hanging around.
I think he went – agree with you when you say the word pretender, but I think he'd agree with you that, you know what, they're not a challenger in the play. They're not, you know, and they're fine.
Well,
with that
they're not even going to be in the playoffs. I don't think they're going to end up making it.
Frosting on the cake for them. They're sticking to their plan and good move there, you know. And it was interesting, Joe, because, you know, I had a scout say to me earlier this year that the worst thing that can happen to a team like in New Jersey's situation is that they make the playoffs, maybe grab a round or even two. And then they think they're way further ahead than where they are in their rebuild. You know what I mean? And so I think, I mean, it would be nice for them to make the playoffs for their organization. Obviously, get a little money at the gate and something more for the fans to watch. But you don't want to lose track of the bigger picture there. And I think sometimes that's what happens when these teams make the playoffs too early, so to speak.
Well, and this is almost the mirage.
It's kind of like the Bruins.
I was going to say, this is almost the illusion that I think the Bruins are under, you know, on Causeway Street a little bit, as they look at the Florida Panthers as the lead dog in the Atlantic Division, see scenarios where maybe they play the Florida Panthers in the first round of the playoffs and say to themselves, oh, you know, anything can happen in a series. This team could definitely beat the Panthers in a 7-game series and sort of delude themselves into making moves based on that or operating fully off of that assumption. And I just don't see it. You know, I haven't seen enough in playoff style games to think that they're going to beat any of these teams.
Yeah, we said it,
you know,
before. Yeah.
In a playoff series. If you look at the top teams that are in the playoffs right now, Florida, Detroit, Tampa Bay, Washington, Rangers, Islanders. Who of those do you think the Bruins beat in a 7-game series? I don't think they beat any of those teams in a 7-game series.
Yep.
Even though they've had some pretty good success against the Islanders earlier this season, I don't see them beating any of those teams in a best of 7.
If the Bruins look at the Florida Panthers, they should be looking at them to emulate them and how to build a team and start to you know, obviously they haven't stunk as bad as the Panthers in the past and been able to build through the draft, but they should look at them on how to build a young team and how to really gel a team together and take your time.
And take their lumps for a couple of years in order to see that nucleus grow together, let those players get their time, make their mistakes, grow together as a unit to get better as a team.
And that's a great point, because Fleur, I mean, if you think about it, Fleur, I feel like the last 2 years, the Panthers have kind of been like, you know, up until this point in the season, have been looking at a playoff spot. And we're like, wow, maybe this is the year the Panthers, but then they don't, but they took their lumps. They learned, they went in there, they got battle tested, and now they're ready to take that next step. The Bruins aren't there yet, whether they want to admit it or not.
Absolutely. Western Conference, obviously Dallas is hot again, and they're starting to turn it on. And, you know, clearly they're one of the top teams. Chicago, we know about them. LA is the tops in the Pacific. Anaheim is coming on now.
That's the team that scares me the most out of anyone in the NHL
right now. Heavy, strong, just playing their style.
They waited.
If they can get another, because they know that the playoffs are where they need to prove it, right? The regular season, they have nothing left to prove. I would say contender Anaheim, they've shown me plenty. Pretender St. Louis, I still don't buy into what St. Louis is doing. I still think they're a team. And I think Dallas is a pretender too. You know, they're going to have a great regular season. They're going to score a ton of points, but they're going to absolutely fold in the playoffs.
I'm with you. I do not think Dallas is built for the playoffs at all. As we've seen, like it or not, the playoffs becomes a game of defense and strategy. Once you get that far, and they're just all offense to me. And this is a team that, you know, I think it's fun to watch. Kind of brings you back to those glory days of the Oilers in the 80s and the early 90s with the Penguins. But I just don't think they're ready to take that next step in the playoffs. They'll get there, and, you know, maybe they win a round, but I don't think they're ready to really make a run yet. But, you know, we bring up Anaheim there, and you look at the teams that have won the Cup in the last 3 years, whether it's been the Kings or the Blackhawks, right? Those teams each year kind of floated around, bided their time, and turned it on right about now.
Even the Bruins steamrolled. Even the Bruins did that.
The Bruins too, in 2011. Yeah. Same thing. So it's about pacing yourself there and knowing that you have the team to do it and applying it on the ice. I'm not saying you're losing games on purpose by no means, but I'm just saying you realize that you're never out of it. You stay within striking distance, and then you make your run. And that's what the Anaheim Ducks are doing right now. And they're maybe finally going to make me look good as I pick them to win the Cup. So I think they've got a good chance of going there.
16-4-2 in their last 22 games, the Anaheim Ducks.
All started in that game against the Bruins, too. You saw
they were already turning it on at that point. Yeah. But that was another.
That's when we started personally.
I think that was when a lot of East Coast people started to say, okay, maybe they're on to something here. L.A., Anaheim, and Chicago, I think, in the West, and then everybody else as far as serious Stanley Cup contender status.
That's an interesting team to watch, right? Don't you think they could be up to something huge at the deadline, I think, Joe? I know they went out and they got Johansson, but I think they're definitely going to get a good backup goalie because Rene's struggled a bit and it will push him a little more. And then I still see him getting more offense. They've got still have plenty of defensive prospects to trade. So that's an interesting one. Maybe that's a match for Louis Erickson and the Bruins. They've got tons of defensive prospects.
Well, and John Ferguson Jr. and Don Sweeney have both scouted Nashville at points, you know, leading up to this. So I think anything is possible. I also don't think the Bruins have exactly had their phone ringing off the hook to this point for Louis or anybody else. So that's going to need to change in the next couple of weeks as well. We'll see how it plays out, Murph. But as we both kind of agreed on, L.A., Anaheim, Chicago, Washington, and pretty much everybody else.
I'll put the Rangers in there, too.
All right, put the Rangers in there.
Yep.
All right, Murph, another week in the books. We thank Pierre McGuire for NBC Sports for coming on and talking a little bit about his upbringings and his opinions on Claude Julien and the Bruins as well.
Scotty Bowman influence there?
Absolutely. And Claude Julien has said a lot of the same things as far as just the adapting through the years and what a great guy he is. But it's interesting to hear how the older generation, especially a guy as accomplished as him, helps people like Pierre, the next generation out, to really succeed and get to where they are. As it always is, it's a very small hockey world out there, Murph.
It is.
For this week, That'll be it. Remember, as always, keep it great, keep it American, and always keep it about hockey.
If you want to hear more Comcast Sportsnet podcasts or learn how to subscribe to our iTunes feed, head over to csnne.com/podcast.